This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about a massive $3 billion stimulus that's coming to Indiana schools over the next few years. The relief funding is meant to help schools recover from the pandemic, but there are a lot of different ways the money could be spent. And it's been difficult so far to learn exactly where these resources are going to go. To find out more, we're joined by Dylan Pierce McCoy, investigative education reporter at WFYI. It's a pleasure to have you back with us, Dylan.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Let's get to the beginning of this whole story, and if you can sort of take us back to how the federal funding came about and where it's coming from.
Yeah, so this money started flowing pretty early in the pandemic with the CARES Act. That gave money to schools to sort of cope with these whole new set of needs that they were dealing with that came about because of the pandemic. So they started using it for buying laptops and hotspots for students so they could do school remotely, for cleaning supplies, for PPE, all of these costs that they just hadn't imagined having to deal with before. That was a pretty small amount of money given the scale of the catastrophe that came in CARES, but there have actually been two stimulus bills that gave more money to schools since then, and that money is just a staggeringly large amount for education. So that's the money that schools are trying to decide how to spend now, this sort of three waves of aid that they've received over the course of this pandemic.
And you mentioned that some of the funding or some of the aid that was received was for things like PPE and cleaning supplies and all that. Is there a specific purpose for this temporary funding this time around?
So schools have a lot of flexibility in how they spend this money, but I think that we can think of the purpose in sort of two big buckets. One of them is how schools can use it to keep operating when they're under all this pressure right now. So that means they can use it to get students in person into classrooms. Maybe that means hiring extra staff, you know, more bus drivers so the buses aren't as crowded, more teachers. And they can use it to improve remote instruction because we know that's going to keep happening. And then the second area is making up for what kids have missed out on, right? So we know that students have missed out on a lot during the pandemic and that schools are going to have a lot of work to help them catch up academically. And this money can help foot the bill for that. So those are sort of the big, broad purpose for this aid.
The pandemic has had a pretty big impact, obviously, on education and students and teachers and staff over the last 2 years. But is there a sense for some of the specific common problems that this money could help schools address?
Yeah, as you noted, like we have evidence now that kids are behind academically because they've missed out on so much instruction. And so I've heard a lot from schools about ways that they are going to try and use this money to help them catch up. Summer school is a really common thing. So districts will expand summer school, offer it to more students that maybe couldn't do summer school before. They'll be offering that. A lot of places are lengthening school days so they can add more instruction at the end of a day, or they're bringing in tutors. We're also seeing students dealing with a lot of trauma because they are living through the same pandemic that the rest of us are. And schools are the front line for responding to that. They can use this money to hire more counselors or to add programs that they think will help with student mental health. So because they have so much flexibility in how they spend this money, it's really up to districts to decide what they think will make the biggest difference for their children.
So does that mean, for example, a school district could decide we're going to use this money for COVID-related things only, or we're going to use this money to buy the 3D printer we always wanted?
I think that it's really about thinking through what the benefits will be of the spending. Maybe the 3D printer is part of some new program that you're creating to have more, you know, crafts and making, and that is part of your plan for addressing student mental health. I mean, districts have faced criticism for how they've spent this money. I know I've read about districts in other states that are using it to build or improve athletic facilities. That gets people riled up. And I think that there's room for debate on what is actually worth spending this money on, because it's such a rare opportunity that school districts are getting this amount of money. Like, I've been reporting on education for, you know, more than 5 years. And this story, like, schools get a huge influx of money is not a common one. So I think how they choose to spend it is a really important decision. And maybe the 3D printer, they have a really good reason for doing that. But I think it's more common for districts to spend it on things that have an obvious connection, like summer school.
Well, how much money are schools in Indiana getting from this stimulus? Is it evenly divided between all the schools that are here, or are some getting more than others depending on sort of like equity and access?
Yeah, it is not evenly divided. So the state schools in Indiana are getting about $3 billion. The state's getting some additional money on top of that. Most of how it's divided is driven by these formulas that prioritize school districts that are serving large numbers of students from low-income families. So what that means is that when you look at how much each district is getting, sort of an affluent suburban district might be getting a comparatively low amount of money given how many students they have, whereas high needs districts with lots of students who come from low income families are going to be getting a lot more money per student. One example of that is Gary Community Schools. They're getting about $15,000 per student from this federal stimulus money. That's a lot, and it's a lot more than most districts in the state are getting.
And the funding that comes in this way, I just want to make sure I'm not confusing this. So when you say per student, that doesn't mean they're getting like a voucher or something of that amount and they can go somewhere else. That's just what the school is able to spend per student.
Yeah, no, that's honestly, it's just a way of conceptualizing how much this is and comparing districts that are obviously of way different sizes, right? So the largest districts in the state are going to be getting the most money. But when you look at it for per student, it's the highest needs districts and schools that get the largest amount per student. So the $15,000 is just a way of comparing Gary to other places.
Is there a timeline on this funding? Do they have to spend it by a certain time? And is it coming in chunks, or is this $3 billion all at once?
So it came in waves as Congress passed these different stimulus bills. But the really important timeline is the deadline to spend it. They have 3 years to spend it from now. So it's pretty quick, honestly, given how much money it is, especially for the districts that are getting a lot of it. But they do have time. They can spend it next year and the year after.
Is there any potential that getting this money could have some, I mean, I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer here and say negative effects, but, you know, it's a temporary funding that is coming to these schools. They might set up programs that are really great, and then in 2-3 years, there's no money left. Do you think that this is going to have any effect on how schools spend their money?
I think that we shouldn't be worried that this money will have a negative impact, but there are concerns about the fact that it's temporary. You're getting at an issue that school district leaders and experts are really focused on, which is that if you look at school budgets, the biggest expense is salaries, right? And I did visit an Indianapolis charter school at the beginning of the year that's getting a lot of money because of the students that they serve. And what they decided to use it on was to really staff up. So they said, like, we're getting so much money. We think what's going to make the biggest difference for our students is if we hire more teachers. And they added co-teachers to a lot of classes in that school. I went to a middle school math class that had two veteran math teachers in it. And they said that gave them time to work more one-on-one with students to make sure they understood what they were going through in class. And so students weren't confused and sort of to get through material more quickly. And that they thought that would really make a difference for students. But a lot of schools are really afraid to do that because of what you're pointing to, which is they don't want to hire a bunch of staff that they're not going to be able to pay for when this money runs out. So that's been a real source of anxiety and has been a real factor in how schools and districts decide to spend this money. Some are saying, you know, we can't think of anything that's going to matter for our students as much as more teachers, as much as tutors, as much as another social worker. And others are really reticent to do that. So they're looking to spend this money on short-term things. And we've seen a lot of districts offer stipends to staff to pay them for some of the extra work they've put in during the pandemic, but those are also temporary. We also see districts spend it on short-term things like facilities improvements. You know, if you replace a roof on a building, that's not going to be a recurring cost that's new for your district.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of questions and things that have to be looked at to find out how folks are going to spend the money. And, you know, I wonder, is this challenging for smaller districts that aren't used to this much extra money to figure out what they're going to do?
I think it's challenging for every school district, honestly. Larger districts are usually getting lots of money. Smaller districts might not have the administrative capacity to deal with this. I mean, they have to meet a lot of compliance requirements because this is federal money. So there is an administrative burden to that. But also deciding how you're going to spend money when you suddenly have a ton of money you weren't anticipating, that's a really challenging process. And I have heard that it's hard from basically every financial official or superintendent that I've spoken to about this over the last year. I think everyone's glad to have this money. They are super grateful, and like they know that it's essential at this time when they're in a crisis that just keeps going. But it does add a burden to administrators who are already trying to deal with this crisis. So it's a particularly it does have some challenges in addition to being a bit of a blessing.
Yeah, it sounds like it's like a great deal of responsibility being placed on their shoulders while getting much needed relief. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the $3 billion in federal relief funding that's coming to Indiana's schools and what we know about how school districts might use it. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today, we're talking about a huge stimulus coming to Indiana's schools from the federal government, $3 billion over the next few years, meant to help schools bounce back from the pandemic. But it's been a challenge to find out what many school districts will actually do with that money. We're talking about it with a reporter who's been following the story. With us again, Dylan Pierce McCoy, investigative education reporter at WFYI. Dylan, so we've talked so far about where this money is coming from and what it's meant to address. What do we know right now about what school districts are going to do with it? I know we kind of tackled that a little bit in the previous segment, but do we know any specifics on any kind of projects that are underway?
Yeah, I think what we know, well, first of all, schools are already spending this. So if you are a parent and you're noticing that there are new programs in your schools, if your kid is getting new technology from school, this money might be paying for that. We know that a lot of schools have used it to go one-on-one and to help pay for devices for students. I've also talked to a lot of schools about facilities improvements they're looking to make with this money. One of the most common ones I hear about is fixing and upgrading ventilation, which I think makes intuitive sense to us. But they can also use it for other things that are improving learning conditions for students. So, for example, the Gary School District, which I mentioned earlier, they're using it to fix roofs. We've also seen school districts spend it on expanding summer school, to hire additional staff. I know some are using it for more social workers and more teachers. And then the other thing is stipends. We've seen a lot of places use this for stipends for teachers to compensate them for the extra work they've put in during the pandemic, and other staff as well, stipends for, you know, bus drivers, cafeteria workers, to acknowledge sort of how difficult this time has been.
Is there anything in the stimulus that requires schools to be transparent and report how they're using the money either to the government or to the public?
So this has evolved. There's been some criticism that the federal government didn't track the money enough at the start of the pandemic, just because it was kind of trying to shove the money out the door so that districts had it when they needed it right then. States are required to submit annual plans going – sorry, not plans, annual reports going forward, sort of saying how this money has been spent. And schools are also required to publicly post their spending plans under the most recent stimulus bill. I think we also shouldn't be – I think there's reason to be concerned that it's hard to find public information on how districts are spending this. But I haven't heard as much concern from folks that districts are going to be spending it in ways that are sort of outright waste, fraud, and abuse. There are controls in place. The state is overseeing the spending. Districts need to submit applications, and they also need to submit for reimbursement. So it is being followed, but it's still hard to see from the outside how the money is being used.
Are there any rules about what schools just cannot spend the money on, or is it pretty open?
It's pretty flexible. There is guidance about how schools can spend the money. They definitely have to spend some of the money on learning loss and helping kids recover academically. That's like we mentioned, summer school, more teachers, that kind of thing. But there's a lot of ways to sort of fit things into the guidance on how they spend this money. Facilities, definitely. I'd be interested to see what happens with the places that spent this on athletic facilities. But it's pretty broad. And also you can use it. I mean, money is fungible, so you can use it to pay for teachers and then take money you would have spent on teachers and spend that on something else. So we're really relying on school districts to spend this money wisely and on states to track that and on the public to pressure them to spend it in ways that we think will matter the most for students.
What have you found out trying to find out different districts' plans? Are you running into unanswered questions? Is it really difficult to get information?
Honestly, figuring out how districts plan to spend this money has been a huge challenge for me as a reporter, and this is literally my day job. So it's not that I would say that this is a secret that school districts are trying to keep from people. I expect that it's being discussed at school board meetings all across the state. But if you want to get a broad picture of what's happening in Indiana schools across the state, it's really hard to do that right now. And what I've done to find out what districts are doing with their money is usually call those districts and say, what are you doing with your money? Because they're required to post these public spending plans under the most recent round of stimulus, overwhelmingly there is some information available on district websites. What I found was that information is often really hard to find on the website. Just because something is publicly posted doesn't mean it's obvious where it's going to be. And so I got a list from the State Department of Education with links to where those plans are posted. And we made a database out of those that we just published today. So if you want to know a little bit more about how your school district is spending this money, you can go to WFYI's website. And we have links that the district shared to their plans. Then once you dig into those plans, though, there's a lot of variability. Some school districts are clearly working really hard to get information out about how they're spending this money. South Bend, who you're speaking to an official from later in the show, I was really interested in their approach to this, where they did put a lot of information on their website. So you can look and say, oh, they're spending 10% of their money on summer learning. And it looks like they're spending another 10% on stipends for staff and educators. But in other places, even once you look at those public plans, they don't actually communicate a lot about what their priorities are. So I looked at Anderson, and theirs is like a list of things they could be spending money on. One of the things on that list is summer programming and or after school instruction. And they don't have monetary amounts next to those things. So if you live in Anderson and you want to know what the district is prioritizing and really putting their money behind, you can't find that out on their website readily. So you need to be the kind of person who regularly goes to school board meetings or who reaches out to the district, and maybe you can get more information that way. But it's pretty spotty what you can get. Some places it's really good. Some places it's a lot harder.
Is any of this related to just issues with transparency overall in the system, or is this a separate issue?
I think that's a really interesting question. It does mirror other transparency issues that go on in districts, especially around school finance. It varies a lot by district, and even in places where information is available, that information isn't always comprehensible. You know, it isn't always easy to understand. I spend a lot of time following up with financial officials in districts, asking them to explain to me the information that's publicly available, because reading through the document alone isn't enough. And then the people who see that information are the people who go to school board meetings every month, which, like, you can say something is public, but in reality, not a lot of people are going to school board meetings every month. So I think that that is its own sort of set of issues around transparency that we're seeing now with this federal money. We see it always. There are rare moments when people really engage in school finance, usually when property tax referendums are coming up. So then the school district is really doing a campaign to get people to vote, to give them more money. And what will happen is they'll do a lot of public meetings. They'll do a lot of presentations. People will come to those meetings because they know this is on the ballot. And that's the time when I see people really digging in and understanding how school districts are choosing to spend their money. But a lot of times this is information that's public, but not really publicly discussed.
Right. And I wonder, as you mentioned, with school board meetings, and if people aren't going to those, they don't really necessarily know what's happening. Do you think school districts are doing enough to get parents and the public engaged and get their feedback about what should be done with money? Or is that something they are taking care of on their own and it really doesn't matter what anybody else says?
It depends. I'd say the most recent stimulus bill required districts to get input on their spending plans. Some put surveys out to parents. Some had community meetings. I haven't heard about anywhere where that's been a really robust process that, like, a lot of people have gotten excited about how this federal money is going to be spent. That's not to say it's not happening, but I haven't heard too much about it. But I do think it's hard to overstate how difficult this has been for school districts to try and get parents involved, to give them sort of the benefit of the doubt. They got this latest wave of money in the spring, and it's hard to get parents involved in a decision-making process when the school year is about to wrap up. It's hard to get parents involved during the summer. They're just not tuned in. So the challenges that you already face with the community engagement were exacerbated by the fact that they had a pretty short timeline to hear from parents. And they were dealing with, you know, the end of one of the most difficult school years I'm sure anybody had to face. So I think some school districts worked harder than others, but it's been really rare to see people deeply engaged in this.
Can you tell us about the grassroots group Hoosier Action and what you heard from them related to this?
Yeah, so as I keep repeating, like, getting people involved, community engagement is super hard. And so I wanted to talk to somebody who has tried to do that in not just a compliance-focused way, but, like, really show the community that they have a voice in these decisions. And so that's how I ended up reaching out to Hoosier Action. Now, they didn't work on the issue of federal funding for schools, but they're familiar with the challenge because they did a lot of work on federal funding for other institutions. And they were encouraging residents to give input on how cities and counties use their COVID stimulus money. So here's a clip from the communications director, Tracy Hutchings Goetz.
Folks are not, across the board, are not used to thinking of these public institutions or even their, like, city or county government as a thing that they can impact. And there was a lot of, you know, time and time again, we would see like a lack of imagination. We would spend a lot of time working with people to be like, no, you really, like, you can impact this. You get to decide.
So lack of imagination seems, I don't know, counterintuitive to the education field.
I mean, I think the people who spend a lot of time thinking about education had ways they wanted to spend this money, right? But if you aren't used to education budgeting, if you're a parent or a community member, maybe it takes something to get you to a place where you're like, oh, I want to do something different, or I actually have a voice in this, you know, to get past just accepting what administrators want to spend the money on.
You did a story in September about Gary Community Schools and the impact this could have there. And I'm guessing that this money could change some things. But what did you hear from parents in Gary about this money?
Yeah, so Gary is really interesting because it's been in dire financial trouble for years. It was taken over by the state because it was so broke. And at the same time, many students come from very low-income families. So when this federal funding came around, the district got just a huge amount compared to similarly sized districts. And it's also getting some new loans from the state, and they voters approved a property tax referendum. So all of a sudden, a district that's been cash-strapped for years is flush with money. And I really wanted to hear from parents about what they wanted to see happen with that money, what difference they think it could make for their district. There were sort of mixed feelings. Some parents were frustrated that the state-appointed manager is going to be the one that decides how to spend this influx of money. But others were really optimistic that it could help pay for essentials, including things that the district hasn't had for years. So one of the parents I spoke to was Kimberly Kimball, who is a Gary parent and graduate. She says she thinks a lot of money will be used to fill gaps that existed. I'm going to play a clip from her now.
Because we were running at such a deficit for so long, it seems like a lot of money, but I'm pretty sure in the grand scheme of things, by the time they distribute it to all the areas where we were behind and updating the school, having proper curriculum, paying the teachers, you know, a wage that we can retain them, we're really excited about what it's going to mean to really get the money that we should have had.
And she mentioned the money that they should have had. So that's pointing out that this is a district that probably should have received better funding in the past.
I mean, I think that's a matter of opinion, but it's definitely a district that has suffered a lot because they haven't had enough funding. They've lost a lot of students over the last several decades. And because of the way that Indiana funds school, that's meant they've had less money. But you can really see it, even just in the structural issues in the Gary School District. You know, I was tuning into a state meeting earlier this year, and it was basically raining in someone's office. Water was dripping down the wall because they had such bad roof problems. So they're going to use some of this money to fix roofs there, which is really essential. Like, those ceilings have been dripping for years, and it's been coming up in state meetings for years. They're also using some of this money to pay for things they would have used state loans for, and they're using those state loans to improve athletic facilities, which in Gary they say is really important because they had, you know, football field that was in such bad shape, sometimes other teams didn't want to come play on it. They had a track that also was, you know, pockmarked by disrepair. So these are things that have really impacted students' lives. And because they're getting all this money, they're able to make all sorts of facilities repairs. I think we're expecting them to do other things. We also know they're extending the school day. But this is a district that where you've really seen the consequences of not having enough funding.
Before we wrap up, I'm curious, do you think districts will become more transparent in the coming months as their plans become more solid? Or could this be something where we don't really know what's going on?
I hope that districts will become more transparent as their plans become more solid. I hope that they'll talk about what a remarkable amount of money this is and the opportunity that they have. I know that we will know how districts spent the money after the fact. But what I think is really important is that we see it as those decisions are being made, because it's really crucial to spend the money on things that matter for the students that need it most. And if we aren't hearing from districts how they're choosing to spend the money, then the public can't voice its opinion. It can't pressure them to spend it on things that it prioritizes. So I hope we'll hear more as they decide. A lot of places have told me that they're going to be talking about it more. But either way, I know this will really influence education for students for years to come.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dylan Pierce McCoy, investigative education reporter at WFYI. After a quick break, we'll look closer at one school district in the state to get an idea of what impact this money might have. We'll hear from a leader in the South Bend Community School Corporation to ask about their plans. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about the $3 billion in federal relief funding coming to Indiana schools over the next few years. The stimulus is meant to help schools bounce back from the pandemic, but so far, it's been difficult to find out what districts are actually going to do with this new money. To get a glimpse into one Indiana district and their plans right now, we're joined by Karima Fowler, Chief Financial Officer for the South Bend Community School Corporation. Thank you for joining us, Karima.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So far in the show, we've been speaking with our education reporter about what this new federal relief funding is, but we wanted to talk to someone to get a sense for how it might affect a specific district in Indiana. How much money are you getting at the South Bend Community School Corporation?
We're getting a total of about $93 million.
$93 million. That sounds like a lot to folks who are probably just tuning in, but I don't know, does that not even go a long way for a school district?
It's a shot in the arm. However, once you break it down per student, it's not as much as you think it is. And then we also, there was a small portion of that went to our non-public schools as well.
What was your reaction when you first heard about this relief funding?
My reaction was that it's funding that would be funding that's much needed and would be put to good use at such a time as this.
Before we talk about how you plan on using these funds, can you tell us about your district and the community there?
Our district is about 70% free and reduced lunch. So we have roughly over we're a little under 16,000 students. We have a high minority population. ELL and migrant population. And a lot of those students were already, behind. And when you couple that with some of the other challenges that we faced during COVID and not, initially having all the access that they needed from the onset, it's been pretty difficult. We dealt a lot. That's why I said the money is definitely a tool that was needed. I would say we dealt early off with just meeting the social emotional supports and bridging the digital divide and helping them get access. So first you start there and you start with food and then everything else after. So it's been challenging. We've been able to make the pivot pretty well. Just because we were already working on what some of our virtual options would look like. But it's still been difficult and very challenging given our population. And even when we chose to still serve food while kids were out of school, even that was difficult given the population of, our employees who actually go out and do this work. We would have our food service department, the entire department, basically down at one time. So it's been very challenging.
It sounds like, when we talk about funding and schools receiving this money, maybe there's, I don't know if I would say like a stereotype or something where the schools that have all this access, it sounds like they're just drowning in money, whereas other districts which have been dealing with lack of access and equity this whole time, this was just maybe a drop in the bucket.
I agree, because we had just went for a referendum, because we did not have all the things that we needed in our district. And we were dealing with other losses financially in education, in terms of our funding. So we were already struggling with trying to figure out how to fill those gaps. But then you throw something like COVID on top of that, that really, really, those areas where people are really struggling, those gaps really starting to widen. So you're correct. I think people think that it's so much money, but when you're starting at, you know, sometimes if you're starting, you know, under zero, is not a lot of money.
What are the plans that you have so far, or do you know how you'll be using the funding?
Yes, we definitely, we broke our funding out, and we basically kind of, we stuck with the different allowable buckets and how the money should be spent. You know, the IDOE made a lot of recommendations, but definitely accelerated learning. So we have before and after school supports. We have tutoring. We're doing a Saturday accelerated learning on Saturdays, the Saturday school. Then we're definitely doing it as much as we can to support our educators and their social emotional health. We are updating our tech and making sure that all the students have one-on-one devices. So a device at the school, but also if they need a device to take home, they have a device to take home as well. For shutting down. And that's pretty expensive given all of the other things that goes with it. Because we've had to give mobile hotspots not only to families, but also to our teachers that didn't have internet. So we've done that. We're working on our infrastructure with technology, but also we have to, while we're doing this at the same time, look at long-term sustainability and how do we partner with others so that once this money is gone, we can continue, because you also have this expectation. And that's what a lot of people don't talk about. Once people get access and they get all of these things, how are schools, once that money is gone, going, now the expectation is there. How are you going to be able to keep that going? So we're also focusing on our partners and who could we partner with right now for long-term sustainability to make this realization of students having a device at school and a device at home and access to the internet long-term. So we're doing a lot with our local city, and we have a citywide connection. So we are getting internet into as many households permanently as we can by collaborating with our local city government and putting money together. So that is working really well for us. And we're looking at other alternative options as well. Phones and other things that are out there and new innovations and technologies for long-term sustainability. But then we also want to make sure that kids are safe. And so updating our infrastructure in terms of our filters in the buildings to HEPA, but also looking at how do we reimagine how we reach and teach our students, because I don't think things will ever be the same after this. And then making sure that no student is falling through the gap or left behind, because not only do you have the educational piece, but now you have a technological piece as well, a socio-emotional, an extended social-emotional piece. And we saw that with kids coming back to school after they had been out for so long, it was really hard for them to be in a classroom with each other and cope with each other and be in a structured setting. That was very difficult. And so there's just a lot there. There's a lot, and we don't know what the answers are. But this additional funding does allow us to also try different things that we would not have been able to try, different interventions that we weren't able to try before, because we would have been just too cash strapped to even try anything outside of the box to see what could actually work.
You know, one thing that I've wondered is with technology and bringing in computers for everybody, it seems like that's a never-ending cost too, just you know, you can get the funding for it, but you know, there's the updates and then things change. And even from my own perspective, when I have a phone, you know, like in 2 years, all of a sudden it stops working, you got to update it. And so yeah. How hard is that on schools when it's like, you want to give everyone the technology, but it just keeps changing and you have to have money to upgrade?
Yes. But that was the point that I was saying about our, once you do that, you know, now there's this expectation that kids will have these devices, and how, what do you do for sustainability? How do you maintain that? And that's where those partnerships come in at. And that's why we're partnering with our city. We're also partnering with our local universities to figure out how can we make this, how can we come up here locally, how can we come up with a long-term solution for our students so that we could keep technology and innovation circulating with all the updates, because there is definitely a cost.
I can only imagine
why the partnerships are extremely important right now with this funding.
Were you
because
able
we can't
to
do it alone? And we know that the issues that have come from COVID, they are community issues, right?
Right, right. I mean, it affects everybody. Were you able to engage with parents in the community about sort of the process or get feedback on what they wanted to see the funding go towards?
Yes, we had town halls. We had several town halls. We had a lot of information. For us, we had a lot of information when COVID came, just because we had just went for a referendum. So we had been out in the community, you know, listening to parents and families and seeing what their needs were, not what so much what they wanted, but what were their needs. So we already had a good like baseline of what needs were. We went out and we did community tours, community listening tours. We tried to put out as much information as possible. But I will say this did not go without challenge, just because during the pandemic, it was kind of hard at times to reach people. You know, you weren't going out in the public. You were switching things to online. You know, a lot of times some of the feedback that we wanted from some of the families, we were not really able to get with those families. So we started going to, okay, how can we bring this to, so we started going like to the churches, we started going to the local community centers, and we would have our, where we know people were going to show up, where they were going to show up there for food, like food banks and different, because there's a group of people that you never really hear from. How do you reach those individuals to make sure that their voices are heard? So we did launch a campaign, and we started going out to those locations where we knew people would come. They were coming there already. It wasn't something that we were putting on. We would go there because we knew the people were going to be there, and we would try to give them information and get information. And so we did our best, but it was challenging because you had to do it in a short period of time. All of these, for us, everything had a deadline. We had to submit an application. That application had to go through a process of approval. So all except the first round, there was no application we submitted, but we had to submit an application for CARES 2, ESSER funding 2, and then ESSER funding 3. We had to submit a fully baked, you know, applications of what our plans would be. And so we did not have a whole lot of time to plan out with the amount of money that we were given. We didn't have a whole lot of planning time per se. It was challenging, but the good thing about it is that these plans that we have, they're living documents. So they're not set in stone, and we can go back in and make amendments and adjust those plans as the needs of the corporation changes.
You mentioned that folks can see the spending that you're doing.
Yes. So we have a ESSER funding tracker online. Because of, you know, everything with all the money and what everyone's hearing about the money, and we felt it very important to be transparent about the money we were receiving and what we're doing with it. So we have a ESSER funding, a CARES funding tracker online, and it's broken out by supporting educators, accelerated learning, and sustainable innovation, tech, and other infrastructure. And you can go online and track that spending. We update that every single month. You can go to our website at South Bend Schools, sbschool.com.
And so when it comes to some of the biggest challenges your district has faced in recent years, were any of the challenges things that came up during the pandemic that either weren't there before or just weren't as much of a problem? And I mean, I wonder if it's even a fair question when we're talking about equity and access and where some schools were just so much farther behind in access than others and when the pandemic hit.
That's true. I'm not even sure of that. Yeah. And I agree with you. I don't know that it's a fair, I don't know that it would really be a fair question, because what we saw in the pandemic is basically whatever you saw in the pandemic really just exposed what was already there.
Yeah.
Is how I see it. A lot of times these things existed, but if you didn't have the proper resources to fix it, it just existed, right? And I think governments just worked on, you know, with what they had, and they continued to plug away on, you know, doing the best with what they had and the information they had at the time. And I think the pandemic just exposed what was already there.
What are you hopeful for as we head into 2022?
My hope, what I'm hopeful for, I think there's been so many things that was already there that has really, and so many gaps that has really been exposed to the point the issues have to be addressed. I mean, they have to be addressed, and they have to be addressed head on. The one thing about the pandemic did not discriminate against anyone, right? So everyone kind of got to feel the same thing. So, you know, maybe families that weren't used to certain experiences, now they're able to put themselves in another person's shoes. And I think only good can come from that. I think the pandemic has been a real true testament to our resilience, our resilience as people in the educational community, our resilience as, you know, educators. And I really look forward to what's to come, because we've all had to think outside of the box. None of us have been exempt. We've all been uncomfortable. We've all been stretched. And I think sometimes that's necessary. And I think we do have to reimagine how we reach and teach our children. And I think right now with the pandemic, that has changed the tide. I think there's a lot of work ahead of us, and no one should be shying away from that. There's a whole lot of work ahead of us. But I think the pandemic has pushed everyone in ways that, you know, just it wouldn't have happened pre-pandemic.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Karima Fowler is Chief Financial Officer for the South Bend Community School Corporation. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.